theocracy. I mean, a theocracy that was about 2,000 years old. The society was still organized that way in Tibet. And when the People's Republic of China reclaimed its citizenry over Tibet and sent its troops in and its organizers and its social welfare people, all these people came in, the U.S. media were filled with stories about these beautiful monks who had to be carried to India, who are now deprived of their religion. They weren't deprived of their religion. You could practice Buddhism in China if you want. What they were deprived of was their enormous wealth. The thing that the media didn't tell us about was that in Tibet, those monks ruled that country. Those peasants lined up and gave their food, their livestock, their everything else. They exploited that peasantry. Those monasteries were rich. It was a feudal theocracy that lived off the backs of these peasants. And those monks had a good thing going for them. And that class was blown away. What the media doesn't also tell you now is that the average peasant in China, for whatever else you want to think about or say about the People's Republic of China.
Listen to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We're listening to Michael Parenti's talk about the political uses of religion. So please stay tuned to Back in USSR.
The average peasant in Tibet today goes to school. He gets enough to eat. His kids get enough to eat. He's got a co-op, a communal farm, whatever it is to work on. He's got some place to go to. He gets medical attention when he needs it. And those things did not exist when God ruled in Tibet. We also could note how theocracy, I mean this thing about this erratic quality of religion sometimes, when one of the most murderous and repressive theocracies emerges today, in the last 8 or 9 years, in Iran. The right-wing faction of the Shiite movement won a victory in Iran. You know, when they blew up all those mullahs and those guys who came for a mass meeting, that was the sort of the mujahideen, the reformist group. They were all slaughtered in one blow. The mullahs who rule in Iran and live off the people and live very well and are carrying out this endless, murderous war against Iraq with the assistance of our cowboy in the White House there. And also right here in America, as the previous speaker pointed out, there has been a real resurgence of this religious right. For generations, religionists have served corporate capitalism. They've preached obedience to the status quo. They've opposed workers trying to organize and form unions. They've opposed syndicalism, socialism. It was portrayed as the work of the devil. And in turn, capitalists, the big rich robber barons and the owners, were inclined to present themselves as the recipients of the deity's highly selective blessings. Let me quote one of them. John D. Rockefeller Sr., quote, "I believe the power to make money is a gift of God. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money, and still more money, and more money, and more money, and more money. And to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience." So from this we may conclude that God is a financier. And so too today, social and political leaders constantly call upon God. Every president of the United States feels compelled to do this. But no president more so than Ronald Reagan. And it's a little scary. You know, it's one thing for certain right-wing evangelicals to announce that the Bible prophesies an imminent apocalypse, that we are now in the third and final stage, the third and final millennium. That the Antichrist forces from the East, as portrayed by Gorbachev in Russia, will meet destruction, Israel will convert, and Christ will return triumphant to deliver death upon the non-believers and elevate the believers up to eternal life into heaven. It's one thing to hear that from Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. It's quite something else when the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, tells us, or is indicating that he embraces the same mythology, that we may be getting close to the apocalypse, the final judgment between East and West, and it's a matter of public record that he's entered into such conversations about this impending apocalypse with Jerry Falwell and other fundamentalists who themselves have talked about it, and his wonderful grasp of the Bible and how the president really knows all this stuff. Before the National Association of Evangelics in March 1983, President Reagan proclaimed, quote, "There is sin and evil in the world, and we are enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might. The Soviet Union is an evil empire," unquote. "And the United States nuclear arm race against the Soviets is," quote, "a struggle between right and wrong, good and evil." So God, it seems, is a Cold War militarist who is preparing us for a final nuclear confrontation. A lot of this, of course, was said before the Soviets kept coming and putting everything on the table and saying, come on, let's negotiate and all that. And millions of people got out there and demonstrated and said, go to Geneva and all that sort of thing. He's been dragged kicking and screaming to Geneva. And so now he looks like he's interested, but he has managed to avoid any single arms agreement up to now. And he may very well avoid any arms agreement. Well, they say that the Russians are scared of Reagan, and I don't doubt it because so are many Americans. It's one thing when the fundamentalist Reverend Bailey Smith, then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tells a right-wing political rally that God, quote, does not hear the prayer of a Jew. God is an anti-Semite, turns out. That is after he converted. It's something else when the president of the United States announces that the United States is, quote, a Christian nation. Now, this surely must come as news to a loyal citizenry, which includes over 6 million Jews, several million Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, and millions upon millions of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and non-sectarian deists, who together probably compose a majority of our people. It's something when Reagan gets up there at his State of the Union message and says, this country and our Constitution could not have been formulated without divine guidance. So I sit there and I'm saying, so God is not only our father, he's our founding father. As a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear on this. The framers at Philadelphia left the deity very much out of it. And when Benjamin Franklin suggested that their daily sessions should open with a prayer asking for divine guidance, they voted it down. And Alexander Hamilton said, we don't need foreign aid. The Constitution is very clear that ours is not a Christian nation. Article 6 reads, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And by the way, that was a distinct and democratic advance for one who has a very critical view of the Constitution, who feels it wasn't a very democratically motivated Constitution. Let's say that was a democratic victory for the people. It was even ahead of many state constitutions, which in those days banned Jews, Catholics, and non-believers from holding public office. And of course, the most democratic victory came not with the founding fathers, but with the concession they had to make, they were forced to make because of those democratic forces, and that was the Bill of Rights. When Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, let's have a Bill of Rights, that was voted down almost unanimously. I think Massachusetts abstained. Later on, they realized their tactical error, and they realized that they wanted to get this thing ratified. If they're going to win some kind of popular support for it, they'd better give the people something besides what they gave themselves in the Commerce Clause and all those other goodies and bills and credits and all the other stuff for themselves. They had to give the people something, and they put through a Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. Yet, the Reagan Justice Department is taking a regressive road back toward theocracy. A, ruling that the government can spend taxpayer money to subsidize religious schools. B, supporting a move to amend the Constitution so as to allow teacher-led prayer sessions in public schools. And C, pressuring the religionist crusade against safe and legal abortions. Now, here again, we're witnessing not only the religionist's use of politics, but the politician's use of religion. Take that last issue of abortion. These guys don't care one way or another about abortion. As a matter of fact, they had the opposite position. A matter of fact, conservatives for years supported legal abortion because their view was that the poor had too many babies and there was too many kids on welfare, so let's have abortions, get rid of those kids. That was their position for years. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he signed the most liberal abortion bill in the world. And his daughter had an abortion, didn't bother him at all. George Bush supported legal abortions. They've all changed now. They've all come over. And why they came over? Because they found political gold in that area. Because Richard Viguerie got up and said, hey, this is how we can split the Democratic Catholic vote. Hey, this is how we can win more of the Protestant fundamentalist vote. And Viguerie even said it. When Reagan appointed Sandra O'Connor, he said, is she soft on abortion? We cannot give up this issue. This issue helps us split the Democrats. I mean, it is the crassest case of political opportunism. Once more, as in Luther's day, using religion as an instrument of maintaining your power, religion as an instrument of class control. And Reaganism has brought forth not only the politically more conservative religious spokesmen, but also the theologically more reactionary ones. Those who evade all real social issues. You can watch these guys on television all day. You'd never know there was something called pollution, or acid rain, or poverty, or exploitation.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we're listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Political Uses of Religion. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Employment, or inflation, or unfair tax laws, ruinous tax laws. You never get a sense of that. You never get a sense that people are desperate, fighting, trying to stay ahead of themselves, wondering how they're going to get through their old age. You never get any of that. All you know is that you're to blame, you're weak, and all you got to do is open up your heart to Jesus, and it'll all be saved. It'll all be worked out. They have no attention to poverty, oppression, to militarism. What they do is focus on personal pieties, sectarian intolerance, and a kind of prudish, repressive moralism. In the face of all the things we have to struggle with today, they're targeting Playboy magazine. Their message is the same as it's been for centuries, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Don't organize and struggle for social justice and against the powers that be, against the powers that exploit you, against the powers that take the money out of your paycheck before you can even get it home. Don't fight against them. Just trust in God and God's love, and above all, keep those contributions coming in. And what a God it is they sell. We already know from reading the Bible that the Judeo-Christian God is vainglorious, sadistic, murderously partisan, vindictive. In fact, if you had a person like that, you wouldn't want to associate with him for 5 minutes, let alone worship him. You might recall that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, including all the unoffending and innocent children and infants in those cities, because he didn't like the lifestyle of certain of the citizens and what they were doing. He took great satisfaction when his Israelites acted like imperialists and massacred. You read the Book of Kings where he says, and the Israelites slew 20,000. The first time I read that, I was astonished. I said, my God. And God was pleased. And the Israelites went out and they slew 35,000 and killed them all. And God was happy. I said, my God, what a God. Not my God. And today it hasn't changed all that much to some degree, this whimsical, murderous God. When Mother Teresa, just last year, when Mother Teresa's plane skid on the runway, killing five of her admirers who were waiting there to receive it and maiming a whole bunch of others, she got off and she said, this was the will of God. And I'm saying to myself, but this God is Caligula. This God is one of or some other homicidal, mad despot. We also know that God is a terrorist and an extortionist. Listen to Oral Roberts, who says that God's going to zap me unless they come up with 8 million smackers by the end of March. By the way, Oral Roberts made that same plea last year. He said, unless I get it by the end of December 1986, God will take me. And he denied saying it until they produced the tape, the videotape with him saying it. He said, oh, did I say that? Well, I say so many things. The truth is, he says he frantically needs that $8 million for missionary scholarships. That's a lie, ladies and gentlemen. His financial empire is in serious fiduciary trouble. It's been in trouble for a number of years. And he is going to go under, and that's what he needs that money for. It's not God that's after him, it's the bankers. And what transpires in these money-grabbing forays is something right out of the Dark Age. In one TV interview I saw, Roberts was sitting there being interviewed, he and his wife there, and he was explaining his whole appeal to this other guy who was talking to him. This is about 3 months ago. I saw this on TV, and he said, well, about $3 million come in, and then when the money stopped coming in, Satan appeared. And I'm sitting there saying, what does he mean, Satan appeared? You thought that's bad. Then his wife chimes in. She says, that's right. Satan appeared, and I said, Satan, you get on away here. You leave my husband alone. You get out of here. And Satan, he just ran off like that. And I said, where am I? And the credulous audience actually applauded. And I said, what is this? Where am I? Is this candid camera? What is this? Am I a little Johnny Lollipop in Disneyland? Are they talking? I mean, the image of this plucky little woman standing there with, perhaps with her rolling pin and chasing off the Prince of Darkness. I mean, it just... this is something, I said, is this the 12th century? Then I thought, they couldn't get away with this in the 12th century. If some priest got up and started talking like that, probably the curia would call him up and say, what's this you're selling? Because they have a monopoly on those kind of contacts. On another occasion, I saw Jimmy Swaggart on TV, fulminating, you know, and going and twitching his frenetic bulk across the stage back and forth. And he paused at one moment and he says, hold on, as if a celestial long-distance phone call suddenly came to him. God is calling me and God is telling me something. And then he stopped and then he told them what it was. I forget, I didn't write it down. But then I'm sitting there and saying, I can't believe it. This guy actually now claims that he got this message, and they're sitting there believing this, you know? Can I do an experiment here, please? Would you all just put your hands up like this? Just put your hands up and say, close your eyes, wave them a little bit. Do you feel it coming down your hands? Well, I'm working a much harder room than Jimmy Swaggart did, you know. But doesn't work. I don't have it down yet. All right. Then there's, of course, Pat Robertson, who turned a Republican presidential nominee who turned a hurricane away from his home state with God's direct intervention. And God, if he's anything, is a meteorologist. There's the Baptist minister, Everett Sullivan. Now, this guy ran in the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. Four candidates, he came in fourth. And a woman won. And worse, to make matters worse, the Democratic nomination, a woman run. So here was the Republican gubernatorial race, two women running against each other. So what did Sullivan says? He says, this was a curse, evidence of God's curse. Quotes from the Bible, the good book, right? The good book. Jeremiah plainly tells us that when, I'm quoting Sullivan, Jeremiah plainly tells us that when the people of a nation are willing to accept the leadership of a woman, it is a sure sign of God's curse. Unquote. Talk about a sore loser, huh? Well, we always knew God was a male supremacist, too. Now, the point I want to make here is less a theological one than a political one. It's that the crude religionism of the right, it demonstrates not only the obviously anthropomorphic origin of the God image, but also the exploitative, opportunistic use of religion as an instrument of oppression, as an instrument of material acquisition, as an instrument of political power and political privilege. It is not merely that the God hucksters are silly and superstitious, rather they are keenly self-interested, manipulative, and politically powerful. Not only do the religionists preach pie in the sky by and by, but they live high off the hog here and now. While preaching otherworldliness to their followers, they're up to their ears in the crassest pursuits of wealth, power, class interests, and if we can believe what's happening to Jimmy Baker, other crass pursuits. They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves.
Listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and we're listening to Michael Parenti's talk, The Political Uses of Religion. Please stay tuned to Back in USSR.
They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves. However, as I say, although history moves, and I'll sort of wrap it up here, although history moves in fitful and often uncertain steps, the general thrust has really been forward. Important democratic victories have been won. Theocratic forces still menace us. They enjoy unexpected resurgence, but they no longer rule over the Western world the way they once did. Even the Mullah theocracy in Iran is not as successful as it thought it would be in exporting the Ayatollah's fanaticism throughout the Middle East. And even the Reaganite political religionist revivalism is not really doing all that well, neither in Congress, nor in the courts, nor in elections and primaries, nor in the public opinion surveys. Jesse Helms had to quit that big filibuster he was doing for school prayer and all that, because it wasn't getting anywhere. Because the response, even from his own state, people are hurting for real. You know, they're losing their farms, and this guy's sitting up there talking this hocus pocus. He had to retreat on that issue. Also today, in about a third of the world, in existing socialist countries, in communist countries, the oppressive, horrible, totalitarian Congress countries, theocracy has been thoroughly vanquished, which is not to say that religion is prohibited. Every traveler who's gone there, including Billy Graham, says that people are free to practice their religions. I was in Moscow. I was on a tour of political scientists and economists. Fort Greer, another fellow political scientist, sociologist, was on that tour. He can testify. We went into a church, and there were all these people, Russian Orthodox Church, they were praying and going on. Priest was, And I said, well, if this state is repressing this religion, it's doing a sloppy job of it, I must say. And there's freedom for synagogues, churches, Baptists, Jews, Church of Christ, Roman Catholic denomination. The misrepresentation in the West on this issue, and it's constant that religion isn't free in the USSR or other communist countries. And I think it's, again, another political use of the religious issue, because for the religionist, communism is a threat. Not only because atheism is not tolerated, but because atheism has an official status as a creed. And this is what the religionists cannot forgive. The Soviet Constitution reads that atheists have the free right to the open and free propagation of their creed. The freedom for atheist creed. And by the way, in socialist countries, about the only ones I know which explicitly give that constitutional protection to atheists. So it's kind of ironic, you know. In evil totalitarian Russia, atheism has achieved a pluralistic safeguard superior to what is found in our own supposedly democratic pluralistic society. And there's more open, unharassed freedom of belief in communist countries for religious believers than there is for atheists in the USA. We can also witness a new revolutionary development within the ranks of religion itself, especially in Latin America, with liberation theology. And the threat of liberation theology is that it doesn't diminish man to God, but puts him as the center of God's concern, and it also speaks for the interests of a different social class from the one that religionists usually represent. Liberation theology is not for theocracy, but against it. It's not for what the French call le prêtre du double menton, the priest of the double chin. It's for the hungry and the immiserated. To the extent that liberation theology has this democratic social content, it represents an historically progressive development, even if we can still disagree with them theologically about things. Instead of conjuring up a god who is the object of pietistic idolatry and interior imaginings, liberation theology sees God as manifest in social justice, in economic betterment for all the people, a more decent life here on earth, so that the lowliest among us shall be among the best, and the parasitic, the exploitative, the oppressors, the plutocrats, the dictators shall be cast aside. That's really a subversive religion. That's really getting close to what Christianity really pretended it's supposed to be about. And also in the USA, there's a Christian left that's developed, it's emerged, which sides with the poor, with the political refugees from fascism and the peace movement, and which does not support the kind of Reagan restrictions, the kind of breaking down of church and state walls, and the kind of restrictions on other people's creeds. So for some believers, at least, it seems that God is not a jingoist or a militarist or a financier, but he's a pacifist and a progressive and maybe even a revolutionary. So it becomes clear that God is about as good as the people who believe in him, which is understandably so, since he is made in their image. My own view on God is the one that's offered by the great American theologian Woody Allen, who once said that maybe God does exist, but he's an underachiever. Imagine being omnipotent and producing this, right? Tornadoes, plagues, fascists, all these things. Well, what is to be done? Three short points, then I'll sign off, and I'm sure others will have other things to suggest here. The immediate goals that we might consider worth struggling for. First, we have to get the religionists off welfare. Make the rich churches and the multimillionaire TV evangelists pay a fair share of taxes on their immense holdings and investments. We have to get their hands, their loving, beseeching hands. We have to get those hands out of our pockets. We've got to have them stop this theocratic rule where the state forces us to subsidize them in their propagandizing of their faith, which is a violation of our beliefs and a violation of the Constitution that is using the state in that way. Not propagating their faith, they can do that. Second, free thinkers, liberation theologists, atheists, agnostics, etc. should have equal time on television. I just wrote a book called Inventing Reality, which deals with the way that political ideas and information are controlled by the news media, but the same thing could be said about creed. Alternative views are systematically shut out. Dissident opinions get no hearing. I mean, occasionally a local radio show, Madeline Murray Hale will be interviewed or someone else like that. But for the most part, you could just see that it's not a non-secular TV. Dissident opinions get no hearing. There's no free market of ideas. Third, we must roll back Reaganism and its war against the First Amendment and its war against the separation of church and state and against our freedom and our beliefs. And that we can... And I think the Reaganites have been weakened by the Iran-Contra scandal, and so there are new opportunities for us to fight back. Not just to complain, but to fight back. And not to feel that they're all so powerful and they're so dangerous. Not, they're dangerous, it's true, but you have to do what the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci once said, and what Madeline Murray O'Hare practiced, even though I bet she didn't read Gramsci on this point. He said, you must have a pessimism of the mind, be able to see the worst, the dangers, and an optimism of the will to fight back and know that there are victories that we could win and more of them will be ours. This is what we want. Even though some of us may not realize it, we are part of very much of a long historical struggle. We are involved in making history, a little, just a little bit of it, maybe a paragraph was made right out there today. To those who would make the world safe for hypocrisy, we say that our country needs something more than freedom of religion. We need freedom of belief, including the freedom not to believe in spirits and demons without putting our jobs and civil liberties at risk. Our historic task is not to vanquish religion, but to vanquish theocracy, I think, and with it, all the abuses and privileges upon which it feeds. This, ladies and gentlemen, would be, and it will be, a great victory for humanity and for democracy. Thank you.
Boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin. Attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs. I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance. Burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons. And plus my math, distribute cash among the classes. Take from the grieving greedy bastard. Get back like church hats or get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throw. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Original rap at taking shit back. Boom bap, boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Hey Guelph, mark your calendars because Kazoo Fest is coming up from April 6th to the 10th. Kazoo is dedicated to showcasing emerging musicians and artists, and this year's fest includes such amazing acts as Chris Dirksen, Luca, Mauno, Matt Manoogian, Julie Dwaron, Chad Van Galen, Nap Eyes, Yonatan Gat, and so, so much more. Kazoo Fest will be taking place in various locations in downtown Guelph, and festival passes cost $55 plus taxes and can be picked up at the Bookshelf, which is 41 Quebec Street, and TicketBreak.com. You can also get tickets at the door if you're early enough. For a full list of performers, venues, and accessibility information, check out kazookazoo.ca. That's Kazoo Fest, happening April 6th to the 10th in downtown Guelph. Kazoo Fest is made possible thanks to the help of our sponsors, including CFRU 93.3 FM, Cornerstone, Wellington Brewery, Ontario Arts Council, City of Guelph, and the Department of Canadian Heritage.
Are you drawn to aggressive sounds? Are you subject to violent outbursts of rage? Do you have sudden urges to destroy everything in sight? If so, we have just the thing for you.
Forever Death!
Forever Death on 93.3 CFRU, Thursday nights at 10 after 10 following the BBC.
Metal for Hospice will be at Maxwell's Concerts and Events at 35 University Avenue East in Waterloo on Sunday, April 3rd. Metal for Hospice is a charity concert for Lazard House, which is a hospice care center in Kitchener-Waterloo. This is a nonprofit event with all proceeds going to Lazard House. The event is all ages and is physically accessible. Join us for amazing performances featuring co-headliners By the Blood and Prismind, as well as Calling Chaos and Mirrors and Tides. Tickets are $10 in advance and $15 at the door and can be picked up at ticketscene.ca. Doors open at 7 p.m. and the bands are on at 7:30. That's Metal for Hospice, happening Sunday, April 3rd.
Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California, and we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Prophet Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello, how are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity.
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people. Scarcity and hardship, and that's done by those at the top who work us,
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation of by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. What was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term, like, all the time these days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity, you know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich, it's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the Depression. But that war got people out of the Depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down, and there was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education, these things. That they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise which we had to, you know, keep up with the Reds.
Right.
And here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was I'm adjusting something here. You had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West. And that's when the mythology also emerged that America is the land of prosperity. And for whatever prosperity, they really, advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America we have, everybody's got a car now, and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these superhighways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah. So of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right. Austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 19, as they say, the 80s or so is a turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
That's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back, Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. How things are, and it came out overwhelmingly. People saying it was better under communism. Better under communism. The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and. And students, it was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, and more accessible. And you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how. War is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So, how does that really imperialism tie in with austerity?
Imperialism. The empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes? Right there, that's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism. But it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal, and to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And yeah. If it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's mm-hmm. why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so that they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they, too, underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos. And even in the area of food, where the food is, some of the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, and expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know. Mm-hmm. And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity, stop looking for a handout from the government, stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare. Mm-hmm. And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself, I'm telling no, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right, like who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same agency goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies, agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry piping up their racket. It's gotten more. It's given people more services, but it has been a. But these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits. I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, you know, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I'll say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper, the service is better, You don't have CEOs who are making $2, 3, 4 million a year as a CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else. Mm-hmm. We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company is too busy scooping of profits for itself, and it blew up and 8 people were killed and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them, they were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Our public transportation here carts more people than that congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants we can say, it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop and they really have the little touch to it than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go with social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And,
yeah.
This is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system...
Yeah, this
and
was
there's never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company.
Yeah.
That's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so
yeah.
forth. But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this
right.
is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, oh, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Then the cleanup goes to socialism.
Oh, right, yeah.
Also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the costs every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
of the...
a private one, you said? Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli due to lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. It was a big scandal back in like 1995.
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased like oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big, big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that were had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being being ready to blow up or something.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that, but it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers. And well, I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native indigenous peoples in North America, and 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost three centuries.
Mm.
Just destruction, to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation,
mm-hmm.
Indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And so I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and
mm-hmm.
Holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I
mm-hmm.
think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too in some instances, you know. So yeah, it's just got a lot. There's just an awful that you know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize